Welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the New York Times, from the Washington Post, from Religion News Service, and more. Today's broadcast is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article from the New York Times dated January 14th. And this is an article about a new book that was released last week, I believe it was, apparently co-written by Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. And the headline in this article, Two Popes and One Big Führer After Benedict Weighs In on Priestly Celibacy. The subheadline, in a new book, the former pope makes a firm defense of celibacy for priests, as Pope Francis is expected to decide whether to allow married priests in remote regions. Let the intrigue begin. This article is by Jason Horowitz and Elisabetta Povoletto of the New York Times, Dateline Rome. The theologically fraught relationship between two living popes, fictionalized in a current movie, is beginning to have very real consequences for the obligation of celibacy for priests in the Roman Catholic Church. It wasn't supposed to be that way. Pope Benedict XVI, the first pope in the modern era to retire, promised when he stepped down in 2013 and took the title Pope Emeritus that he would remain hidden to the world. But in a new book written in part by Benedict, to be published on Wednesday in France, the former pope makes a firm defense of priestly celibacy at the same time that his successor, Pope Francis, faces a critical decision on whether to lift the restrictions on married priests in remote areas. It is a move that Francis seems open to, but his critics consider a first step on a slippery slope toward the end of the centuries-old tradition. To be certain, Francis is the pope and is the one with the power to promulgate dogma. Benedict retired in 2013 and lost all such powers. But he has maintained, among a small but powerful coterie of conservatives, the power not to just influence, but to validate their views with an ex-papal seal. The question now is whether he is a player or a pawn in the ideological battles. Benedict is being taken advantage of, said Roberto Rusconi, a church historian who considered the book an open and direct attack on Francis by reactionaries inside the church. He said that Benedict had put himself in this awkward position by failing to renounce his title upon retirement and embracing the neologism of Pope Emeritus. There's only one pope, Mr. Rusconi said. An extraordinary Vatican conference in October had recommended that the Pope lift the restriction on married priests in remote areas of the Amazon region, where a severe shortage of clerics means that the faithful often go months or longer without seeing a priest who can administer the sacraments. Some bishops around the world have expressed interest in having married men of good standing be ordained as priests in their regions as well. Francis is currently working on a document with the potential of turning the recommendations from the Amazon Bishops' Conference into church law. It was in that context that on Sunday the French newspaper Le Figaro published an excerpt from a book, From the Depths of Our Hearts, by Cardinal Robert Sarah of Guinea, a top conservative prelate and Vatican official, and Benedict. In the book, the retired pope makes an impassioned case for priestly celibacy, writing about the impossibility of a marital bond for priests, and that in the church's tradition, renouncing marriage became a criterion for priestly ministry. The excerpt became an opening salvo. Whisper campaigns conducted by pro-pope and pro-pope emeritus partisans are nourishing a dueling pope's storyline, with anonymous allegations from Team Benedict in the Italian press suggesting that Cardinal Sarah had inappropriately put Benedict's name and face on the book cover. Talks grew over whether the time had come to enshrine restrictions on the conduct of papal retirees into canon law, and the Vatican scrambled to insist that there was nothing to see here. But with each passing hour, there was more to see. Archbishop Georg Gainswein, Benedict's closest collaborator, who happens also to be the prefect of Pope Francis's household, found himself again caught in the middle of a different popes for different folks comedy of errors. a conservative, Archbishop Genswein, found himself publicly disagreeing with Cardinal Seurat, who spent the early part of the week rejecting allegations that he had tricked the aging Benedict into joining his opposition to Pope Francis's agenda. Benedict, at age 92, is now restricted to a wheelchair and has seemed frail in public appearances, appearing slumped and struggling to speak. When Benedict became the first pontiff to resign since Gregory XII in 1415, his vow to remain hidden seemed to guarantee that he would keep to his refurbished Vatican convent and stay out of Francis's way. But Benedict turns out to be bad at hiding. He has repeatedly chimed in throughout Francis's pontificate. Their relationship, often depicted as a rivalry, has become an object of widespread fascination, most recently in the movie The Two Popes, where the two men are shown watching the 2014 World Cup final, rooting for competing teams. But the truth, as often is the case in the small Vatican city-state, consumed with power politics and ideological rifts, shadowy maneuvering and gossip, is much stranger. In April, only months after a groundbreaking Vatican conference called by Francis to address the Roman Catholic Church's clerical sex abuse crisis, he released a 6,000-word letter holding forth on his views on the scandal's origins. He put the blame on the swinging 60s and sexual liberty, effectively undercutting Francis's view that clericalism, or the abuse of power by priests, had allowed the scandal to fester. That letter marked for many critics an egregious example of why having two popes, whose addresses are close but whose visions of the Church are vastly apart, can be so confusing to the faithful. But the book project appeared to mark an escalation. "I believe that celibacy has great significance as an abandonment of an earthly realm," Benedict wrote in the book, according to the excerpt in the French newspaper Le Figaro, adding that for priests staying on the path to God, celibacy becomes really essential. On Tuesday, Archbishop Genswein told the Austrian Catholic news agency Kat-Press that at the request of the Pope Emeritus, Cardinal Seurat had called his publisher to ask that Benedict's name and photograph be removed from the book's cover, introduction, and conclusion. Benedict had not co-authored the book, Archbishop Genswein explained, but had merely contributed a short text of his on the priesthood. He added that the Pope Emeritus had not signed a contract with the French publisher, Fayard. "It was a misunderstanding, without questioning Cardinal Seurat's good intentions," Archbishop Genswein said. Both Cardinal Seurat and Archbishop Genswein declined to comment. In parentheses, the website of the French publisher, Fayard, proclaimed that Benedict had exceptionally, with his great friend Cardinal Seurat, emerged from his silence to write on one of the most difficult subjects for the Church, the future of priests. Earlier Tuesday, Cardinal Seurat rejected allegations that he had duped the fragile Pope Emeritus. To clear his name, Cardinal Seurat produced receipts, publishing on Twitter Benedict's personally signed correspondence. "Finally, I can send my thoughts on the priesthood," read a letter dated October 12th and apparently signed by Benedict, posted by Cardinal Seurat. Pointing to the letters, Cardinal Seurat added, "I solemnly affirm that Benedict XVI knew that our project would take the form of a book." He also published on Tuesday a statement that called the allegations against him deeply despicable, and cuttingly added, "I sincerely forgive all those who have slandered me or wish to set me against Pope Francis." He detailed his cooperation with Benedict on the book as dating back to September 5th, when he solicited Benedict's reflection on priestly celibacy. "I can imagine that you are going to think that your thoughts on this could be inappropriate because of the debates that they would provoke," Cardinal Seurat said he wrote to Benedict, but he said that he told the former pope that the whole Church needs this gift. Benedict, he said, delivered a lengthy text to him in October during the meeting of bishops from the Amazon region. Cardinal Seurat said in his statement that he was bowled over by the magnitude of the work and asked the pope if he would be willing to combine it into a book with his own meditations on the issue. On November 19th, he said he sent the book's manuscript to Benedict, who later that month signed off, writing, "I agree to publish the text." But letters or no letters, Benedict's involvement in the book created the impression that the former pope was taking a stand against Francis's openness to dialogue on the issue of priestly celibacy. As a result, a campaign to distance Benedict from the book he apparently co-authored pressured Cardinal Seurat to take a step back. Not long after issuing his statement on Tuesday, Cardinal Seurat announced on Twitter that he had spoken this morning with Archbishop Genswein, and that, as per his demands, future editions of the book would present the cardinal as the sole author, with contributions from Benedict XVI. He added that the content, however, would remain absolutely unchanged and that he stood by his previous statement. The book's American publisher, Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, said he had no intention of stripping Benedict's name from the book cover. The text we receive indicates the two authors are Benedict XVI and Cardinal Seurat, he said. Our next article this week on religion in the news comes from the January 6th edition of the Washington Post magazine, and this is an article entitled The Evangelist. The subheadline, Can Shane Claiborne's progressive version of evangelical Christianity catch on with a new generation? And this is by Nick Taper of the Washington Post, and we may edit this somewhat for content depending on how long it runs. It's a pretty long article. On a gloomy Tuesday morning in April, the Christian activist Shane Claiborne was in the studio of WCPN, Cleveland's NPR affiliate, waiting to go on the air. The overhead lights glinted off his thick-rimmed glasses. The 43-year-old had spent the past 5 weeks on a national tour, living in a retrofitted school bus, speaking at community centers and churches every night, trying to accelerate regional movements against gun violence. His collaborator, Mike Martin, a Mennonite blacksmith from Colorado, was sitting to his left. Mass shootings are a horrifying fact of life, the WCPN host, Mike McIntyre, said into his microphone by way of introducing their segment on his show, The Sound of Ideas. Parkland, Las Vegas, Sandy Hook. Beyond thoughts and prayers, which we so often hear in the aftermath of mass shootings, Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin say they have found inspiration, the book of Isaiah. The host recited a well-worn passage, They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Claiborne and Martin had been enacting the verse on tour. They were promoting a book they had written, Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence, and at every stop they were using Martin's forge to convert a rifle into a garden tool. The point was to give communities a chance to grieve, but also to convince them that change was possible. It all reflected the broader project that has made up Claiborne's career, promoting what might be called an alternative version of evangelical Christianity, one more concerned with social justice than with personal salvation. Or, as he would put it to me later, a bit wryly, getting Christians to connect their faith to issues that I think matter to God and are affecting our neighbors. On the table before him in the studio, he had set a pair of handmade garden tools next to his notebook. These look pretty substantial, McIntyre said, gesturing toward them. The tools had long wooden handles attached to jagged steel claws. They used to be guns? Yeah, these were both guns from Philadelphia, Claiborne said in a drawl. He leaned forward. I've been carrying them with me because they're both sort of special to me. Philadelphia has been Claiborne's home for 27 years. He moved there from rural East Tennessee for college, and his career as an activist began during his junior year, when he and some classmates got involved in advocacy for the city's homeless population. He and his wife, Katie Jo Claiborne, now live near the epicenter of Philadelphia's heroin crisis, working with a nonprofit Claiborne co-founded that provides food and housing assistance to the poor. McIntyre took a caller. Let's have David and Kent join the conversation. Hello, David. I would like to ask your guests about some scripture. I am a gun owner, and I will not surrender my guns. The caller's voice quivered with obvious emotion. He quoted a passage in which Christ tells his disciples, If you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It seems to me, he concluded, that Christ is admonishing us to be able to defend ourselves. The caller had more to say, but McIntyre broke in. Let's ask about that then, David. Shane? I was eager to hear how the activist would respond. During the part of the tour I had witnessed, starting a couple of nights earlier in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they had encountered only audiences that seemed to agree with him, mostly lefty Christians spanning many denominations, but also non-religious people who found common cause politically. I think it's a very important passage, Claiborne said, because it does get used often to argue that Jesus was encouraging an armed rebellion, which is exactly the opposite of what I think Jesus was doing. When Christ asked his followers to obtain swords, Claiborne said, he was only trying to air the dirty laundry and get the weapons out there, and ultimately to triumph over the idea that violence is the kind of change that we want to see. Then Claiborne, who was baptized in a Pentecostal church and later studied at Princeton Theological Seminary, showed he could quote chapter and verse as well as any NRA member. So what happens right after that gospel reading that you cited is that Peter actually draws his sword when the soldiers come to get Jesus, and he injures one of them, he went on. Jesus' response is stunning. He scolds Peter and says, put your sword away. You don't get it. If you pick up the sword, you die by the sword. and then Jesus heals the man that Peter wounded. The implications for 21st century Christians, he argued, were clear. When Jesus disarmed Peter, he disarmed every one of us. Because if there was ever a case for standing our ground or using violence to protect the innocent, Peter had the case. This brief exchange captured Claiborne's dynamic with the Christian right at large, which is to say with most of his fellow white evangelicals. He believes that as a group they've lost their bearings, and for 16 years he's been trying to get them back on course by calling constant attention to the example of Christ. Shane is that rare evangelical who challenges the status quo but does so with the Bible as his foundation, says Karen Swallow Pryor, a literature professor at Liberty University, who has herself been a powerful voice for reform in the Southern Baptist Convention. She credits Claiborne for modeling the ways in which Christianity is countercultural and for encouraging young Christians to ask deep, difficult questions, because that's what Jesus did. We've seen figures like Claiborne before. His most obvious predecessor is Jim Wallis, the 71-year-old founder of the liberal Christian magazine Sojourners. Wallis was a media fixture during the George W. Bush administration, and his 2005 book, God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It, spent weeks on the bestseller charts. Wallis helped Claiborne early in his career, and the two remain friendly. But there are stark differences between their approaches. Wallis lives in Washington, D.C., and often works through conventional political channels. His organization runs on a budget of about $5 million. Dadgum, Claiborne said when that figure came up in an interview, we've got, I don't even know what it is, a $150,000 budget. While Claiborne tries to dodge political labels, he prefers suspicionism. Calling him an anarcho-socialist would not be inaccurate. He's been arrested for civil disobedience about 40 times. When I called Wallis to discuss the younger activist, he was quick to point out that he's been arrested in many protests himself. But he also affirmed that his strategy involves engaging more often with people in power. He described Tom Perez, the Democratic National Committee chair, as a good friend, and he served as a faith advisor to President Barack Obama. It's hard to picture Claiborne becoming a regular presence in anyone's White House, even in the event of a Bernie Sanders victory. I feel very complimentary with Shane, Wallis added. By and large, mainstream evangelical leaders have opted to ignore Claiborne. In 2018, for instance, his team organized a revival in Lynchburg, Virginia, where Liberty University is located, and Claiborne invited the president, Jerry Falwell Jr., one of the Christian Right's chief spokesmen, to join him in prayer. Falwell responded by saying he'd have Claiborne arrested if he set foot on the campus. In parentheses, Falwell's statements have time and again landed him in public controversy. Last year, he told the New York Times that he doesn't look to the teaching of Jesus for what my political beliefs should be. One recent news report quoted emails in which he called a Liberty student physically retarded and described the school's then-police chief as a half-wit and easy to manipulate. But millennials and Gen Zers are drawn to Claiborne's authenticity. With young people, he's like a rock star, says the Christian sociologist Tony Campolo, Claiborne's 84-year-old mentor, who has often toured alongside him. I don't know how else to describe him. Wherever he goes, they flock to him. And his popularity has surged since Trump's political rise. He's received piles of letters from disaffected young Christians, saying he helped salvage their faith by showing them a different way of practicing it. Turnout at his events is higher than ever, and his Twitter following has shot up to nearly 100,000. Not bad for someone who's relatively offline. No figure on the Christian right can claim such a large youthful offering. This is all happening against the backdrop of rapidly declining church attendance, particularly among young people. The Southern Baptist Convention alone has lost 1 million members in the past decade. Some of this reflects generational trends. Millennials and Gen Zers are shaping up to be the least religious generations in American history. And some of it, in evangelical churches, is a direct backlash against the leadership's longtime alliance with the Republican Party. Both these trends help explain Claiborne's popularity. With his outsider status, the stark moral clarity of his message, and his concern for the downtrodden, he's tapped into the spiritual sensibilities of the younger generations. In this way, an anarchist may actually represent a new hope for white evangelicals' future. Claiborne grew up in Maryville, a village of some 15,000 in the foothills of Tennessee's Smoky Mountains. "We're hill people for real," he told me on the tour. His father, a Vietnam War veteran, had multiple sclerosis and was using a wheelchair as early as Claiborne can remember. He died just before Claiborne turned 9. Shane is a lot like his dad, his mother, Pat LaFon, told me. We've heard people who knew his dad say when he walks into the room, "I just did a double take." Shane's not quite as funny, but he still has that "I want to entertain everybody" sort of thing going on. The mother and son attended a staid Methodist church, but Claiborne's spiritual life took a turn in high school when some Pentecostal classmates invited him to a service at their warehouse church. He kept going back and was eventually rebaptized there. Though he now attends a vaguely Anabaptist church in his neighborhood, he said he still feels comfortable in Pentecostal settings. His politics as a teenager were deeply conservative. In early signs of his organizing talents, he orchestrated "See You at the Pole" rallies, where students gathered around the school flagpole and proclaimed their right to pray in the classroom. And when Vice President Dan Quayle made a campaign stop in their town in 1992, Claiborne recruited a huge contingent of volunteers. After graduation, he wound up at Eastern University, near Philadelphia. Tony Campolo, who taught full-time at Eastern from 1964 until 2001, says the school is theologically conservative but has long been a hotbed for social activists. Campolo's sociology classes were mind-blowing for Claiborne. "Shane came with a heart for the poor and the oppressed," Campolo said. What sociology did for him was make him aware that there were fundamental changes that had to take place in society to deal with problems of the poor and the oppressed. As a freshman, Claiborne started tagging along with two upperclassmen who hung out with homeless people downtown. The classmates didn't volunteer at shelters or hand out pamphlets. They simply huddled with poor people on the streets and swapped stories. Claiborne soon realized some of the homeless knew the Bible better than he did. It became less about like giving out peanut butter sandwiches and more about like, "These are incredible people and I'm learning a lot from them," he said. Some nights Claiborne and the other students slept on the streets. Other times they brought homeless children back to let them sleep in their dorm rooms. Inspired by these experiences, Claiborne and a friend had the idea of spending a summer in Kolkata, India, volunteering with Mother Teresa's missionaries of charity. Claiborne worked in the hospice, where he helped terminally ill patients eat, massage their atrophied muscles, and gave baths, trying to spoil people who really deserved it. He internalized Mother Teresa's mantra that each time they served a poor person, they were serving Jesus himself. He spent his final weeks there in the leper colony. The year after Claiborne graduated, he and five friends pooled their savings and bought a row house in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood, one of the city's poorest areas, where they had already gotten to know many of the residents. They filed paperwork to become a 501c3, an anti-profit organization, Claiborne later wrote, and moved there in January of 1998, opening their doors to everyone who needed food or clothing. They dubbed their community the Simple Way and took inspiration from long-established intentional communities like the Catholic Worker and Bruderhof. It was a trip to Iraq 5 years later that catapulted Claiborne to minor fame. He tagged along with some other activists in the spring of 2003 on a peacemaking mission, not knowing when the United States might invade. On March 29th, just over a week into the war, he was riding across the Iraqi desert in a three-car convoy bound for Jordan when a bomb went off nearby, knocking his vehicle off the road. Claiborne's shoulder was dislocated. Another passenger was bleeding profusely from a head wound. They were rescued by Iraqi civilians who took them to a hospital. Upon his return, Claiborne was interviewed by news outlets from all over the world. He started writing for Sojourners magazine, then landed a contract to write his first book, The Irresistible Revolution, a memoir that covered his experiences overseas, but focused on his life at the Simple Way. On the tour, I met several people who said the book had changed the course of their lives, inspiring them to devote themselves to the poor or become missionaries. By the time the 10-year anniversary was published in 2016, it had sold more than 3,000 copies. Since the original release of his memoir, Claiborne has written 9 books, including a manifesto for socially conscious Christianity, Jesus for President, and a polemic against the death penalty, Executing Grace. Most feature a co-author. In 2007, he and Campolo launched an organization called Red Letter Christians to connect like-minded communities in a network. It now encompasses about 120 church congregations and other groups, including one in Chile and several in Europe, with plans to launch in more countries this year. Its motto is "Taking the Words of Jesus Seriously," and its website features frequent guest posts with titles like "Women's Voices Rather Than Empty Slogans Must Drive Abortion Debates" and "Facing the Church's Complicity in Racism." Claiborne, who's constantly rattling off quotations from his role models, both in his books and in conversations, invoked the Brazilian Catholic leader Haider Camara to describe the way he splits his time. "When I feed people, they call me a saint. When I ask why people are hungry, they call me a communist." "There are a lot of people who work on the issues and don't always have their feet on the ground," he explained. "And there are a lot of people doing charity work and compassion work who aren't challenging the bigger systems and structures. We're trying to do both." At Cleveland's Pilgrim Congregational Church, the pews were filled with a diverse crowd of a couple hundred. Someone drew my attention to LaTanya Goldsby, a co-founder of Cleveland's Black Lives Matter chapter, when she walked in. Goldsby had become an activist after her 12-year-old cousin, Tamir Rice, was killed by an officer in the Cleveland Police Department. The night's program, like most on Claiborne's tour, was something like a church service reimagined as a political rally, and Goldsby was to be the keynote speaker. Claiborne had on his daily uniform, absurdly baggy brown pants, hand-sewn, and a tan T-shirt over his tall, thin frame. I had initially taken his look to be an ill-advised holdover of 1990s fashion, but then I noticed that from behind, especially with a brown hoodie on, he looked exactly like a Franciscan monk. "Look at your neighbor and say, everything is not all right in the world. Amen." His words began echoing in the pews around me. "Look at your neighbor and say, it doesn't have to stay this way." There were shouts of amen above the murmurs. "We'd kind of prefer that we didn't have to do a 37-city tour talking about gun violence," Claiborne said. "But we've seen too many people die in our neighborhood. A 19-year-old was killed by my house, and we held his hand as he took his last breaths. That is when we remember the words of Dr. Martin Luther King when he said, we're all called to be the Good Samaritan and lift our neighbor out of the ditch. But after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you start to say, maybe we need to rethink the whole road to Jericho." It was time, Claiborne said, to do something about why so many people end up in the ditch to begin with. He continued, "We have in the U.S. about 5% of the world's population, but almost half of the world's guns." "Lord have mercy," the crowd said in quiet unison. "In our country, we've got nearly 5 times more gun dealers than McDonald's restaurants. Lord have mercy." And that's not an argument for more McDonald's. That one always drew a few laughs. Claiborne grinned, but quickly turned serious again. "We also know that the lives lost every day are over 100, close to 109. In 2 decades, domestically in the U.S., we have lost more lives to guns than in 250 years of foreign wars. Lord have mercy. We also remember that tonight that for many of us this is personal." He looked in Goldsby's direction. "This is something that chose us, and for others of us for whom this is not personal, we want to invite you to lean in and to realize that being closer in proximity to the pain of the world is a part of what it means to be human." His volume began to rise and his pacing sped up. "And it's part of what's creating the urgency of this crisis. Loving our neighbor as ourself means that if this is hurting one of us, it's hurting all of us, right?" Everyone was shouting, "Amen." We've gotten about halfway through that story, and we'll finish it up next week on Religion in the News. We certainly do appreciate you joining us for this week's edition. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, and they can be reached at 919-834-3424. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.